"Health insurance?" he asks me, removing the needle and untying my arm. He puts cotton and a band-aid over the puncture. "No, I'll pay for everything myself." I press my fingers against the sore spot, bend my elbow. Kendrick smiles. "No, no, you can be my little science experiment. Hitchhike on my NIH grant for this."
"For what?"
"We're not going to mess around here."
Kendrick pauses, stands holding the used gloves and the little vial of my blood that he's just drawn.
"We're going to have your DNA sequenced."
"I thought that took years."
"It does, if you're doing the whole genome. We are going to begin by looking at the most likely sites. Chromosome 17, for example."
Kendrick throws the latex and needle in a can labeled biohazard and writes something on the little red vial of blood. He sits back down across from me and places the vial on the table next to the camel's.
"But the human genome won't be sequenced until 2000. What'll you compare it to?"
2000? So soon? You're sure?"
"I guess you are. But to answer your question, a disease that is as disruptive as yours often appears as a kind of stutter, a repeated bit of code that says, in essence, bad news. Huntington's disease, for instance, is just a bunch of extra CAG triplets on chromosome 4.
I sit up and stretch.
"I could use some coffee. So that's it? Can I run away and play now? Well, I want to have your head scanned, but not today. I'll make an appointment for you at the hospital. MRI, CAT scan, and X-rays. I am also going to send you to a friend of mine, Alan Larson. He has a sleep lab here on campus."
"Fun," I say, standing up slowly so the blood doesn't all rush to my head. Kendrick tilts his face up at me. I can't see his eyes. His glasses are shiny, opaque discs at this angle.
"It is fun," he says. "It's such a great puzzle. And we finally have the tools to find out."
"To find out what?"
"Whatever it is. Whatever you are."
Kendrick smiles, and I notice that his teeth are uneven and yellowed. He stands, extends his hand, and I shake it, thank him. There's an awkward pause. We are strangers again after the intimacies of the afternoon, and then I walk out of his office, downstairs, into the street where the sun has been waiting for me. Whatever I am. What am I? What am I?
A Very Small Shoe. Spring 1996. Claire is 24. Henry is 32. When Henry and I had been married for about 2 years, we decided, without talking about it very much, to see if we could have a baby. I knew that Henry was not at all optimistic about our chances of having a baby, and I was not asking him or myself why this might be, because I was afraid that he had seen us in the future without any baby, and I just didn't want to know about that. And I didn't want to think about the possibility that Henry's difficulties with time travel might be hereditary, or somehow mess up the whole baby thing, as it were. So I was simply not thinking about a lot of important stuff because I was completely drunk with the notion of a baby. A baby that looked sort of like Henry, black hair and those intense eyes, and maybe very pale like me, and smelled like milk and talcum powder and skin. A sort of dumpling baby, gurgling and laughing at everyday stuff. A monkey baby. A small, cooing sort of baby. I would dream about babies. In my dreams, I would climb a tree and find a very small shoe in a nest. I would suddenly discover that the cat or book or sandwich I thought I was holding was really a baby. I would be swimming in the lake and find a colony of babies growing at the bottom. I suddenly began to see babies everywhere, a sneezing, red-haired girl in a sunbonnet at the AMP, a tiny, staring Chinese boy, son of the owners in the Golden Walk, home of wonderful vegetarian egg rolls, a sleeping, almost bald baby at a Batman movie. In a fitting room in a JCPenney, a very trusting woman actually let me hold her 3-month-old daughter. It was all I could do to continue sitting in that pink-beige vinyl chair and not spring up and run madly away, hugging that tiny, soft being to my breasts. My body wanted a baby. I felt empty, and I wanted to be full. I wanted someone to love who would stay and be there always. And I wanted Henry to be in this child, so that when he was gone, he wouldn't be entirely gone. There would be a bit of him with me. Insurance, in case of fire, flood, act of God.
Sunday, October 2nd, 1966. Henry is 33. I am sitting very comfortable and content in a tree in Appleton, Wisconsin, in 1966, eating a tuna fish sandwich and wearing a white t-shirt and chinos stolen from someone's beautiful sun-dried laundry. Somewhere in Chicago, I am three. My mother is still alive, and none of this chrono-fuck-uppedness has started. I salute my small former self, and thinking about me as a child naturally gets me thinking about Claire and our efforts to conceive. On one hand, I'm all eagerness. I want to give Claire a baby. See Claire ripen like a flesh melon. Demeter in glory. I want a normal baby who will do the things normal babies do. Suck, grasp, shit, sleep, laugh. Roll over, sit up, walk, talk in nonsense mumblings. I want to see my father awkwardly cradling a tiny grandchild. I have given my father so little happiness, this would be a large redress, a bomb. And a bomb to Claire, too. When I am snatched away from her, a part of me would remain. But, I know without knowing that this is very unlikely. I know that a child of mine is almost certainly going to be the one most likely to spontaneously vanish, a magical disappearing baby who will evaporate as though carried off by fairies. And even as I pray, panting and gasping over Claire in extremities of desire, for the miracle of sex to somehow yield us a baby, a part of me is praying just as vehemently for us to be spared. I am reminded of the story of the monkey's paw, and the three wishes that followed so naturally and horribly from each other. I wonder if our wish is of a similar order. I am a coward. A better man would take Claire by the shoulders and say, "Love, this is all a mistake. Let us accept it and go on and be happy." But I know that Claire would never accept, would always be sad. And so I hope against hope. Against reason. And I make love to Claire, as though anything good might come of it.
1. Monday, June 3rd, 1996. Claire is 25. The first time it happens, Henry is away. It's the 8th week of the pregnancy. The baby is the size of a plum, has a face and hands and a beating heart. It is early evening, early summer, and I can see magenta and orange clouds in the west as I wash the dishes. Henry disappeared almost 2 hours ago. He went out to water the lawn, and after half an hour, when I realized that the sprinkler still wasn't on, I stood at the back door and saw the telltale pile of clothing sitting by the grape arbor. I went out and gathered up Henry's jeans and underwear and his ratty Kill Your Television t-shirt, folded them, and put them on the bed. I thought about turning on the sprinkler, but decided not to, reasoning that Henry won't like it if he appears in the backyard and gets drenched. I have prepared and eaten macaroni and cheese and a small salad, have taken my vitamins, have consumed a large glass of skim milk. I hum as I do the dishes. Imagine the little being inside me hearing the humming, filing the humming away for future reference at some subtle cellular level. And as I stand there, conscientiously washing my salad bowl, I feel a slight twinge somewhere deep inside, somewhere in my pelvis. 10 minutes later, I am sitting in the living room minding my own business and reading Louis de Bernier, and there it is again, a brief twang on my internal strings. I ignore it. Everything is fine. Henry's been gone for more than 2 hours. I worry about him for a second, then resolutely ignore that, too. I do not start to really worry for another half hour or so, because now the weird little sensations are resembling menstrual cramps, and I am even feeling that sticky blood feeling between my legs, and I get up and walk into the bathroom and pull down my underpants. There's a lot of blood. Oh, my God. I call Charisse. Gomez answers the phone. I try to sound okay, ask for Charisse, who gets on the phone and immediately says, "What's wrong?" "I'm bleeding." "Where's Henry?" "I don't know." "What kind of bleeding?" "Like a period." The pain is becoming intense, and I sit down on the floor. "Can you take me to Illinois Masonic?" "I'll be right there, Claire." She hangs up, and I replace the receiver gently, as though I might hurt its feelings by handling it too roughly. I get to my feet with care. Find my purse. I want to write Henry a note, but I don't know what to say. I write, "Went to Ill Masonic. Cramps. Charisse drove me there, 7:20 p.m. C." I unlock the back door for Henry. I leave the note by the phone. A few minutes later, Charisse is at the front door. When we get to the car, Gomez is driving. We don't talk much. I sit in the front seat, look out the window. Western to Belmont, to Sheffield, to Wellington. Everything is unusually sharp and emphatic, as though I need to remember, as though there will be a test. Gomez turns into the unloading zone for the emergency room. Charisse and I get out. I look back at Gomez, who smiles briefly and roars off to park the car. We walk through doors that open automatically as our feet press the ground, as in a fairy tale, as though we are expected. The pain has receded like an ebbing tide, and now it moves toward the shore again. Fresh and fierce. There are a few people sitting abject and small in the brightly lit room, waiting their turn, and circling their pain with bowed heads and crossed arms, and I sink down among them. Charisse walks over to the man sitting behind the triage desk. I can't hear what she says, but when he says, "Miscarriage," it dawns on me that this is what is going on. This is what it is called. And the word expands in my head until it fills all crevices of my mind, until it has crowded out every other thought. I start to cry. After they've done everything they could, it happens anyway. I find out later that Henry arrived just before the end, but they wouldn't let him come in. I have been sleeping, and when I wake up, it's late at night, and Henry is there. He is pale and hollow-eyed, and he doesn't say a word. "Oh," I mumble, "where were you?" And Henry leans over and carefully embraces me. I feel his stubble against my cheek and I am rubbed raw, not on my skin, but deep in me. A wound opens and Henry's face is wet. But with whose tears?
Thursday, June 13th, and Friday, June 14th, 1996, Henry is 32. I arrive at the sleep lab, exhausted, as Dr. Kendrick has asked me to. This is the fifth night I've spent here, and by now I know the routine. I sit on the bed in the odd, fake, home-like bedroom, wearing pajama bottoms, while Dr. Larson's lab technician, Karen, puts cream on my head and chest and tapes wires in place. Karen is young and blonde and Vietnamese. She's wearing long fake fingernails and says, "Oops, sorry," when she rakes my cheek with one of them. The lights are dim, the room is cool. There are no windows except a piece of one-way glass that looks like a mirror, behind which sits Dr. Larson or whoever's watching the machines this evening. Karen finishes the wiring, bids me good night, leaves the room. I settle into the bed carefully, close my eyes, imagine the spider leg tracings on long streams of graph paper gracefully recording my eye movements, respiration, brain waves on the other side of the glass. I'm asleep within minutes. I dream of running. I'm running through woods, dense brush, trees, but somehow I am running through all of it, passing through like a ghost. I burst into a clearing. There's been a fire. I dream I'm having sex with Ingrid. I know it's Ingrid, even though I can't see her face. It is Ingrid's body, Ingrid's long, smooth legs. We are fucking in her parents' house, in their living room on the couch. The TV is on, tuned to a nature documentary, in which a herd of antelope is running, and then there's a parade. Claire is sitting on a tiny float in the parade, looking sad while people are cheering all around her. And suddenly Ing jumps up and pulls a bow and arrow from behind the couch, and she shoots Claire. The arrow goes right into the TV, and Claire claps her hands to her breast like Wendy in a silent version of Peter Pan, and I leap up, and I'm choking Ingrid, my hands around her throat, screaming at her. I wake up. I'm cold with sweat, and my heart is pounding. I'm in the sleep lab. I wonder for a moment if there's something they're not telling me, if they can somehow watch my dreams, see my thoughts. I turn onto my side and close my eyes. I dream that Claire and I are walking through a museum. The museum is an old palace. All the paintings are in Rococo gold frames. All the other visitors are wearing tall powdered wigs and immense dresses, frock coats and breeches. They don't seem to notice us as we pass. We look at the paintings, but they aren't really paintings. They're poems. Poems somehow given physical manifestation. Look, I say to Claire, there's an Emily Dickinson. The heart asks pleasure first and then excuse from pain. She stands in front of the bright yellow poem and seems to warm herself by it. We see Dante, Donne, Blake, Neruda, Bishop. Linger in a room full of Rilke. Pass quickly through the Beats and pause before Verlaine and Baudelaire. I suddenly realize that I've lost Claire. I'm walking, then running, back through the galleries, and then I abruptly find her. She's standing before a poem, a tiny white poem tucked into a corner. She is weeping. As I come up behind her, I see the poem. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I'm thrashing in grass. It's cold. Wind rushes over me. I'm naked and cold in darkness. There's snow on the ground. I'm on my knees in the snow. Blood drips onto the snow and I reach out. My God, he's bleeding. How the hell did that happen? Shit, he's ripped off all the electrodes. Help me get him back on the bed. I open my eyes. Kendrick and Dr. Larson are crouched over me. Dr. Larson looks upset and worried, but Kendrick has a jubilant smile on his face. Did you get it? I ask, and he replies, It was perfect. I say, Great. And then I pass out. 2. Sunday, October 12, 1997. Henry is 34. Claire is 26. I wake up and smell iron, and it's blood. Blood is everywhere, and Claire is curled up in the middle of it like a kitten. I shake her, and she says, No. Come on, Claire, wake up, you're bleeding. I was dreaming. Claire, please. She sits up. Her hands, her face, her hair are drenched in blood. Claire holds out her hand, and on it reclines a tiny monster. She says simply, He died, and bursts into tears. We sit together on the edge of the blood-soaked bed, holding each other and crying.
Monday, February 16th, 1998. Claire is 26. Henry is 34. Henry and I are just about to go out. It's a snowy afternoon, and I'm pulling on my boots when the phone rings. Henry walks down the hall and into the living room to answer it. I hear him say, Hello? And then, Really? And then, Well, hot damn! Then he says, Wait, let me get some paper. And there's a long silence, punctuated once in a while with, Wait, explain that. And I take off my boots and my coat and pad into the living room in my socks. Henry is sitting on the couch, with the phone cradled in his lap like a pet, furiously taking notes. I sit down next to him and he grins at me. I look at the pad. The top of the page starts off, 4 genes, per 4, timeless 1, clock, new gene equals time traveler? Chromosome equals 17 times 2, 4, 25, 200 plus repeats TAG, sex-linked? No. Plus too many dopamine receipts. What proteins? And I realize, Kendrick has done it. He's figured it out. I can't believe it. He's done it. Now what? Henry puts down the phone, turns to me. He looks as stunned as I feel. What happens next? I ask him.
He's going to clone the genes and put them into mice.
What?
He's going to make time-traveling mice. Then he's going to cure them.
We both start to laugh at the same time, and then we are dancing, flinging each other around the room, laughing and dancing until we fall back onto the couch, panting. I look over at Henry, and I wonder that on a cellular level he is so different, so other. When he's just a man, in a white button-down shirt and a pea jacket, whose hands feel like skin and bone in mine, a man who smiles just like a human. I always knew he was different. What does it matter? A few letters of code. But somehow it must matter, and somehow we must change it, and somewhere on the other side of the city, Dr. Kendrick is sitting in his office, figuring out how to make mice that defy the rules of time. I laugh, but it's life and death, and I stop laughing and put my hand over my mouth. Intermezzo. Wednesday, August 12th, 1998. Claire is 27. Mama is asleep, finally. She sleeps in her own bed, in her own room. She has escaped from the hospital at last, only to find her room, her refuge, transformed into a hospital room. But now she is past knowing. All night she talked, wept, laughed, yelled, called out, "Philip," and "Mama," and "No, no, no." All night the cicadas and the tree frogs of my childhood pulsed their electric curtain of sound, and the nightlight made her skin look like beeswax, her bone hands flailing in supplication, clutching at the glass of water I held to her crusted lips. Now it is dawn. Mama's window looks out over the east. I sit in the white chair by the window facing the bed, but not looking. Not looking at Mama, so effaced in her big bed. Not looking at the pill bottles and the spoons and the glasses and the IV pole with the bag hanging obese with fluid and the blinking red LED display and the bedpan and the little kidney-shaped receptacle for vomit and the box of latex gloves and the trash can with the biohazard warning label full of bloody syringes. I am looking out the window toward the east. A few birds are singing. I can hear the doves that live in the wisteria waking up. The world is gray. Slowly color leaks into it, not rosy-fingered, but like a slowly spreading stain of blood orange. One moment lingering at the horizon, and then flooding the garden, and then golden light, and then a blue sky, and then all the colors, vibrant in their assigned places, the trumpet vines, the roses, the white salvia, the marigolds, all shimmering in the new morning dew, like glass. The silver birches at the edges of the woods dangle like white strings, suspended from the sky. A crow flies across the grass. Its shadow flies under it and meets it as it lands under the window and caws once. Light finds the window and creates my hands, my body heavy in Mama's white chair. The sun is up. I close my eyes. The air conditioner purrs. I'm cold and I get up and walk to the other window and turn it off. Now the room is silent. I walk to the bed. Mama is still. The laborious breathing that has haunted my dreams has stopped. Her mouth is open slightly, and her eyebrows are raised as though in surprise. Although her eyes are closed, she could be singing. I kneel by the bed. I pull back the covers and lay my ear against her heart. Her skin is warm. Nothing. No heart beats. No blood moves. No breath inflates the sails of her lungs. Silence. I gather up her reeking, wasted body into my arms, and she is perfect. She is my own, perfect, beautiful Mama again, for just a moment. Even as her bones jut against my breasts, and her head lolls. Even as her cancer-laden belly mimics fecundity, she rises up in memory, shining, laughing, released, free. Footsteps in the hall. The door opens and Etta's voice, Claire? Oh! I lower Mama back to the pillows, smooth her nightgown, her hair. She's gone.
Saturday, September 12, 1998. Henry is 35, Claire is 27. Lucille was the one who loved the garden. When we came to visit, Claire would walk through the front door of the Meadowlark house and straight out the back door to find Lucille, who was almost always in the garden, rain or shine. When she was well, we would find her kneeling in the beds, weeding or moving plants or feeding the roses. When she was ill, Etta and Philip would bring her downstairs wrapped in quilts and seat her in her wicker chair, sometimes by the fountain, sometimes under the pear tree where she could see Peter working, digging and pruning and grafting. When Lucille was well, she would regale us with the doings of the garden. The red-headed finches who had finally discovered the new feeder, the dahlias that had done better than expected over by the sundial, the new rose that turned out to be a horrible shade of lavender but was so vigorous that she was loath to get rid of it. One summer, Lucille and Alicia conducted an experiment. Alicia spent several hours each day practicing the cello in the garden to see if the plants would respond to the music. Lucille swore that her tomatoes had never been so plentiful, and she showed us a zucchini that was the size of my thigh. So the experiment was deemed a success, but was never repeated because it was the last summer Lucille was well enough to garden. Lucille waxed and waned with the seasons like a plant. In the summer, when we all showed up, Lucille would rally and the house rang with the happy shouts and pounding of Mark and Sharon's children, who tumbled like puppies in the fountain and cavorted sticky and ebullient on the lawn. Lucille was often grimy, but always elegant. She would rise to greet us, her white and copper hair in a thick coil with fat strands straggling into her face, white kidskin gardening gloves and Smith and Hawken tools thrown down as she received our hugs. Lucille and I always kissed very formally, on both cheeks, as though we were very old French countesses who hadn't seen each other in a while. She was never less than kind to me, although she could devastate her daughter with a glance. I miss her. Claire, well, Miss is inadequate. Claire is bereft. Claire walks into rooms and forgets why she is there. Claire sits staring at a book without turning a page for an hour. But she doesn't cry. Claire smiles if I make a joke. Claire eats what I put in front of her. If I try to make love to her, Claire will try to go along with it. And soon I leave her alone, afraid of the docile, tearless face that seems to be miles away. I miss Lucille, but it is Claire I am bereft of. Claire, who has gone away and left me with this stranger who only looks like Claire.
Wednesday, November 26th, 1998. Claire is 27. Henry is 35. Mama's room is white and bare. All the medical paraphernalia is gone. The bed is stripped down to the mattress, which is stained and ugly in the clean room. I'm standing in front of Mama's desk. It's a heavy white Formica desk, modern and strange in an otherwise feminine and delicate room full of antique French furniture. Mama's desk stands in a little bay. Windows embrace it. Morning light washes across its empty surface. The desk is locked. I have spent an hour looking for the key with no luck. I lean my elbows on the back of Mama's swivel chair and stare at the desk. Finally, I go downstairs. The living room and dining room are empty. I hear laughter in the kitchen, so I push the door open. Henry and Nell are huddled over a cluster of bowls and a pastry cloth and a rolling pin.
Easy, boy!
easy. You gonna toughen them up, you go with them like that.
You need a light touch, Henry, or they gonna have a texture like bubblegum.
Sorry, 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 I will be light. Just don't whack me like that. Hey, Claire!
Henry turns around, smiling, and I see that he is covered with flour. What are you making?
Croissant. I have sworn to master the art of folding pastry dough or perish in the attempt.
Rest in peace, son, says Nell, grinning.
What's up? Henry asks, as Nell efficiently rolls out a bowl of dough and folds it and cuts it and wraps it in waxed paper. I need to borrow Henry for a couple of minutes, Nell.
Nell nods and points her rolling pin at Henry. Come back in 15 minutes and we'll start the marinade.
Yes'm.
Henry follows me upstairs. We stand in front of Mama's desk. I want to open it and I can't find the keys.
Ah.
He darts a look at me so quick I can't read it.
Well, that's easy.
Henry leaves the room and is back in minutes. He sits on the floor in front of Mama's desk, straightening out two large paper clips. He starts with the bottom left drawer, carefully probing and turning one paper clip, and then sticks the other one in after it.
Voila,
he says, pulling on the drawer. It's bursting with paper. Henry opens the other four drawers without any fuss. Soon they are all gaping, their contents exposed, notebooks, loose-leaf papers, gardening catalogs, seed packets, pens, and short pencils, a checkbook, a Hershey's candy bar, a tape measure, and a number of other small items that now seem forlorn and shy in the daylight. Henry hasn't touched anything in the drawers. He looks at me. I glance at the door almost involuntarily, and Henry takes the hint. I turn to Mama's desk. The papers are in no order at all. I sit on the floor and pile the contents of a drawer in front of me. Everything with her handwriting on it, I smooth and pile on my left. Some of it is lists and notes to herself. Do not ask P about S, or remind Etta dinner B's Friday. There are pages and pages of doodles, spirals and squiggles, black circles, marks like the feet of birds. Some of these have a sentence or a phrase embedded in them, to part her hair with a knife, and couldn't do it, and if I am quiet, it will pass me by. Some sheets are poems so heavily marked and crossed out that very little remains, like fragments of Sappho. Like old meat, deleted, no air, deletions, she said yes. More deletions. Or his hand. Deletions. To possess. Deletions. In extreme. More deletions. Some poems have been typed. At the moment, all hope is weak and small. Music and beauty are salt in my sadness. A white void rips through my ice. Who could have said that the angel of sex was so sad, or known desire would melt this vast winter night into a flood of darkness? January 23, 1979. The spring garden, a ship of summer, swimming through my winter vision. June 6, 1979. 1979 was the year Mama lost the baby and tried to kill herself. My stomach aches and my eyes blur. I know now how it was with her then. I take all of those papers and put them aside without reading any more. In another drawer, I find more recent poems, and then I find a poem addressed to me. The Garden Under Snow, for Claire. Now the garden is under snow, a blank page our footprints write on. Claire, who was never mine, but always belonged to herself. Sleeping Beauty, a crystalline blanket, she waits. Deleted. This is her spring. This is her sleeping, awakening. She is waiting. Everything is waiting. For a kiss. Deleted. The improbable shapes of tubers. Deleted. Roots. I never thought. Deleted. My baby. Her almost deleted. Face. A garden, waiting.
It's almost dinner time, and I'm in Nell's way, so when she says, "Shouldn't you go and see what your woman is up to?" It seems like a good idea to go and find out. Claire is sitting on the floor in front of her mother's desk, surrounded by white and yellow papers. The desk lamp throws a pool of light around her, but her face is in shadow. Her hair a flaming copper aura. She looks up at me, holds out a piece of paper, and says, "Look, Henry, she wrote me a poem." As I sit beside Claire and read the poem, I forgive Lucille a little. For her colossal selfishness and her monstrous dying, and I look up at Claire. "It's beautiful," I say, and she nods, satisfied for a moment, that her mother really did love her. I think about my mother singing Lieder after lunch on a summer afternoon, smiling at our reflection in a shop window, twirling in a blue dress across the floor of her dressing room. She loved me. I never questioned her love. Lucille was changeable as wind. The poem Claire holds is evidence, immutable, undeniable, a snapshot of an emotion. I look around at the pools of paper on the floor, and I'm relieved that something in this mess has risen to the surface to be Claire's lifeboat. "She wrote me a poem," Claire says again in wonder. Tears are streaking down her cheeks. I put my arms around her, and she's back. My wife, Claire, safe and sound. On the shore at last after the shipwreck, weeping like a little girl whose mother is waving to her from the deck of the foundering boat. New Year's Eve, 1. Friday, December 31st, 1999, 11:55 p.m. Henry is 36. Claire is 28. Claire and I are standing on a rooftop in Wicker Park with a multitude of other hardy souls, awaiting the turn of the so-called millennium. It's a clear night and not that cold. I can see my breath, and my ears and nose are a bit numb. Claire is all muffled up in her big black scarf, and her face is startlingly white in the moon streetlight. The rooftop belongs to a couple of Claire's artist friends. Gomez and Charisse are nearby, slow dancing in parkas and mittens to music only they can hear. Everyone around us is drunkenly bantering about the canned goods they've stockpiled, the heroic measures they have taken to protect their computers from meltdown. I smile to myself, knowing that all this millennial nonsense will be completely forgotten by the time the Christmas trees are picked up off the curbs by streets and sand. We are waiting for the fireworks to begin. Claire and I lean against the waist-high false front of the building and survey the city of Chicago. We are facing east, looking toward Lake Michigan. "Hello, everybody," Claire says, waving her mitten at the lake at South Haven, Michigan. "It's funny," she says to me. "It's already the new year there." I'm sure they're all in bed. We are six stories up, and I'm surprised by how much I can see from here. Our house in Lincoln Square is somewhere to the north and west of here. Our neighborhood is quiet and dark. Downtown to the southeast is sparkling. Some of the huge buildings are decorated for Christmas, sporting green and red lights in their windows. The Sears and the Hancock stare at each other like giant robots over the heads of lesser skyscrapers. I can almost see the building I lived in when I met Claire on North Dearborn, but it's obscured by the taller, uglier building they put up a few years ago next to it. Chicago has so much excellent architecture that they feel obliged to tear some of it down now and then and erect terrible buildings just to help us all appreciate the good stuff. There isn't much traffic. Everyone wants to be somewhere at midnight, not on the road. I can hear bursts of firecrackers here and there, punctuated occasionally with gunfire from the morons who seem to forget that guns do more than make loud noises. Claire says, "I'm freezing," and looks at her watch. 2 more minutes. Bursts of celebration around the neighborhood indicate that some people's watches are fast. I think about Chicago in the next century. More people, many more. Ridiculous traffic, but fewer potholes. There will be a hideous building that looks like an exploding Coke can in Grand Park. The west side will slowly rise out of poverty, and the south side will continue to decay. They will finally tear down Wrigley Field and build an ugly mega stadium, but for now it stands blazing with light in the northeast. Gomez begins the countdown. 10, 9, 8, and we all take it up. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, Happy New Year! Champagne corks pop, fireworks ignite and streak across the sky, and Claire and I dive into each other's arms. Time stands still, and I hope for better things to come. 3. Saturday, March 13th, 1999. Henry is 35. Claire is 27. Charisse and Gomez have just had their third child, Rosa Evangeline Gomolinski. We allow a week to pass, then descend on them with presents and food. Gomez answers the door. Maximilian, 3 years old, is clinging to his leg and hides his face behind Gomez's knee when we say, "Hi, Max!" Joseph, more extroverted at 1, races up to Claire, babbling, "Ba, ba, ba," and burps loudly as she picks him up. Gomez rolls his eyes, and Claire laughs, and Joe laughs, and even I have to laugh at the complete chaos. Their house looks as though a glacier with a Toys R Us store inside it has moved through, leaving pools of Legos and abandoned stuffed bears. "Don't look," says Gomez. "None of this is real. We're just testing one of Charisse's virtual reality games. We call it Parenthood." "Gomez?" Charisse's voice floats out of the bedroom. "Is that Claire and Henry?" We all tromp down the hall and into the bedroom. I catch a glimpse of the kitchen as we pass. A middle-aged woman is standing at the sink washing dishes. Charisse is lying in bed with the baby in her arms. The baby is asleep. She is tiny and has black hair and a sort of Aztec look about her. Max and Joe are light-haired. Charisse looks awful to me. Claire insists later that she looked wonderful. She has gained a lot of weight and looks exhausted and ill. She has had a cesarean. I sit down on the chair. Claire and Gomez sit on the bed. Max clambers over to his mother and snuggles under her free arm. He stares at me and puts his thumb in his mouth. Joe is sitting on Gomez's lap. "She's beautiful," says Claire. Charisse smiles. "And you look great." "I feel like shit," says Charisse, "but I'm done. We got our girl." She strokes the baby's face, and Rosa yawns and raises one tiny hand. Her eyes are dark slits. "Rosa Evangeline," Claire coos to the baby. "That's so pretty." "Gomez wanted to name her Wednesday, but I put my foot down," says Charisse. "Well, she was born on a Thursday anyway," explains Gomez. "Want to hold her?" Claire nods, and Charisse carefully hands her daughter into Claire's arms. Seeing Claire with a baby in her arms, the reality of our miscarriages grabs me, and for a moment I feel nauseous. I hope I'm not about to time travel. The feeling retreats, and I am left with the actuality of what we've been doing. We have been losing children. Where are they, these lost children? Wandering, hovering around, confused? "Henry, would you like to hold Rosa?" Claire asks me. I panic. "No," I say too emphatically. "I'm not feeling so hot," I explain. I get up and walk out of the bedroom, through the kitchen, and out the back door. I stand in the backyard. It is raining lightly. I stand and breathe. The back door slams. Gomez comes out and stands beside me. "You okay?" he asks. "I think so. I was getting claustrophobic in there." "Yeah, I know what you mean." We stand silently for minutes. I am trying to remember my father holding me when I was little. All I can remember is playing games with him, running, laughing, riding around on his shoulders. I realize that Gomez is looking at me, and that tears are coursing down my cheeks. I wipe my sleeve across my face. Somebody has to say something. Don't mind me, I say. Gomez makes an awkward gesture. I'll be right back, he says, and disappears into the house. I think he's gone for good, but he reappears with a lit cigarette in hand. I sit down on the decrepit picnic table, which is damp with rain and covered with pine needles. It's cold out here. You guys still trying to have a kid? I'm startled by this until I realize that Claire probably tells Charisse everything, and Charisse probably tells Gomez nothing. Yeah. Is Claire still upset about that miscarriage? Miscarriages, plural. We've had three. To lose one child, Mr. DeTamble, may be regarded as a misfortune. To lose three looks like carelessness. That's not really all that funny, Gomez. Sorry. Gomez does look abashed, for once. I don't want to talk about this. I have no words to talk about it, and I can barely talk about it with Claire, with Kendrick, and with the other doctors at whose feet we've laid our sad case. Sorry, Gomez repeats. I stand up. We better go in. They don't want us.